Good morning. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week. And it's 8 o'clock on a Friday, and that means it's time for the Week in Review, where we take a look at the week's stories from a variety of perspectives, including yours. So call in if you've got a perspective on a story, whether it's international, national, state, or perhaps even local, if you can make it apply. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number. In Madison, it is 263-1890. You can also suggest a story on email. That's talk@wpr.org. Got a couple of guests with us, as we do always. This week, joining us in the studio is Ben Mansky. He is a fellow for the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution. It's a nonprofit group that bills itself as a resource to support the development of grassroots organizations. He is also the former chair of the U.S. Green Party. And good morning, Ben.
Good morning to you, Gene.
Also joining us by phone this morning, Owen Robinson, a conservative blogger with bootsandsabers.com, and he is a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. And good morning, Owen.
Good morning, Gene, and good morning, Ben.
Morning, Owen.
Good to have you both along. We've got listeners chiming in already with some of their suggestions, so we'll be getting to those in just a moment. But I'm going to start off this week with a cut that I'd like both of you to react to, and we're going to start off with a comment from President Bush.
If Iran escalates its military action in Iraq,
yes,
to the detriment of our troops and or innocent Iraqi people, we will respond firmly. It makes common sense for the commander-in-chief to say to our troops and the Iraqi people and the Iraqi government that we will help you defend yourself from people that want to sow discord and harm. And so we will do what it takes to protect our troops.
President Bush interviewed on NPR earlier this week talking about the situation in Iran. Owen Robinson, let's start with you. How do you see this thing shaping up?
Honestly, it's a little difficult to look into the future on this one because there's a lot of moving pieces. I think it is clear that if the case turns out to be that Iran has been actively working in Iraq and killing American soldiers, that for America to do nothing is to send the signal that it's acceptable for people to kill our soldiers, which I don't think is what people want to do. The question is given the current political climate within the United States and the current world climate regarding those issues, especially with Russia's and China's involvement, and we saw Chirac back off of any support or any strong stance against Iran earlier this week. The question is, what can be done? And I think what we see happening right now is the United States trying to apply economic pressure because at this point I'm not sure that military pressure or sanctions or anything are really a viable option right now.
Ben Mansky?
Yeah, I think as time goes on, we see the Bush administration looking for more and more excuses and opportunities to ratchet up sort of the belligerence against Iran and to try to bring attention away from Iraq, just as they did a bait and switch on 9/11 to lead the United States into Iraq. And now we're seeing them lead us towards, to paraphrase another unpopular president, a wider war in the region. A couple months ago, if you'd asked me, I wouldn't have thought that we would be seeing the kind of saber rattling we're seeing today in Iran. I would have thought it would have been madness. It would be so clear that a military conflict with Iran at any level would not be in the interest of the United States. But that does seem to be the direction in which Bush administration policy is headed. And I think it raises a question for those in Congress and for the rest of us in terms of the question of impeachment, which is there are those, including the Democratic the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who has said that impeachment is off the table and who has basically suggested that the Bush administration only has a couple of years left. Well, I'd suggest in those couple of years they could do a lot of damage, a lot more damage, and it really is up to Congress at this point to step forward and take some firm measures to rein in an executive that is out of control.
Well, the question is there, Ben, then, is Iran is not, you know, it's not an agent of the United States or the Bush administration. They have made clear indications that they intend to develop a nuclear capability and a clear intention to, quote, wipe Israel off the face of the map. If they appear to be in Iraq killing Americans, I guess what is the option there? What would you have us do? Just do nothing?
Well, first of all, I just to answer that, I don't believe at this time anything the Bush administration tells
us. But this
us.
Isn't from the Bush.
No, read
Ahmadinejad's own comments.
I'm speaking specifically to that point you made about killing Americans, and nothing has been proven in terms of that incident.
Appear.
And I would let me just finish because you asked me the question
okay.
here. It really does bear a lot of similarities to other pretexts that have been used to draw the United States into war, Gulf of Tonkin and WMDs in Iraq. And so I look at that with a skeptical eye, first of all. And secondly, in terms of Ahmadinejad in Iran, I think it is essential that Americans support the opposition in Iran. And we have to ask ourselves, who benefits from the saber rattling? Who benefits from the Bush administration threatening military action against Iran, which they have done repeatedly over the last several years? And I would suggest it's not the opposition. It's not the students who have bravely taken on the regime in Iran. It's actually the regime itself.
And Owen, I'll give you the last word on Iran.
I would just say I absolutely agree with Ben that we need to be supporting the students in Iran. Iran is very different both culturally and historically from Iraq, and does have a very strong, educated middle class that is our ally. But on the other hand, when you have a tyrant in control who has his fingers on a nuclear weapon, not that he does now, but that is clearly his intent, to sit back and do nothing doesn't seem to me to be the best of options.
Let's move on and bring a listener into the conversation right now. Mike joins us this morning, and he is in Spitzer. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, Gene. Hi, guys. Gene, let me first say what a joy it is to find you in this time spot. This is a great show.
Well, I'm enjoying. I'm having fun.
I'm more on the left, I suppose, than the middle on things. I don't understand this non-binding resolution and who it's supposed to send a message to. The president has shown that he's going it alone by himself. I mean, he is on a rampage. He doesn't care. I think it shows a lot of weakness on the party. What they ought to be doing is lining up some of his illegal activities, illegal spying, illegal torture, an absolutely criminal response to the disaster that Katrina caused, mm-hmm. and then impeach him.
Okay, let's take these sort of one at a time here. I think the non-binding resolution you were referring to has to do with there's a whole bunch of them actually in the Senate right now referring to U.S. involvement in Iraq. There's one binding resolution that Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold has introduced. What about all of those resolutions, non-binding or otherwise? And let's start with Ben Mansky on this. Are they going to have any impact on the situation in Iraq right now as things look?
Well, I agree with the caller fundamentally. I mean, mm-hmm. look at November. We had an overwhelming mandate for withdrawal from Iraq, for withdrawal. And now the issue is what's been called the troop surge. And really, that's not the issue. We really should be asking ourselves why leadership in Congress would go along with Bush in terms of, again, changing the issue, taking us off the topic that the American people put on the center of the agenda. And I really do think there is this growing disconnect between Congress and the people. I think Feingold is fundamentally on the right track here. The media should pay more attention to what he's doing. I'm glad to see it's actually gotten some attention. I mean, he's the only one in the United States Senate who really has sort of the platform and who is also moving something that's meaningful, which is a withdrawal legislation. It's called the Iraq Redeployment Act of 2007. And here in Wisconsin, listeners can do something about this by calling the other Democratic senator from Wisconsin, Herb Cole, at 202-224-5653. That's 202-224-5653. And telling him to get behind Feingold's lead in this. And you know, earlier this week, Feingold held hearings, very well attended and covered, looking at Congress's power to declare war. At the end of that, he concluded, Congress has the power to stop the war if we want to. So the question is, do they want to? And I think it's up to the American people to make them want to.
Owen Robinson, what do you think about all the resolutions? Anything coming out of there that's going to make a difference in your estimation?
Well, I agree with Mike that except for the Feingold resolutions, all the non-binding resolutions are their political showmanship, and they're really just underlining something we already knew, that there are members of Congress who oppose the war or oppose the Bush administration's prosecution of the war. They could have saved us all a lot of time and effort and just issued press releases, and we would have gotten the same message. Specifically addressing the Feingold resolution, which calls for withdrawals of cutting off funding in 6 months, essentially giving a six-month window to withdraw. That's a, you know, it is within Congress's rights and power to involve themselves in these decisions. There's a reason we have a separation of powers, and if the Congress is of a mood that they believe that the Bush administration is going awry, they certainly have the power to do something about it, and should, if that's where it goes. But speaking purely politically, I don't see how the Feingold resolution gets through, because ultimately, and particularly in the House of Representatives, where if something like that goes in and we have this chaos where we're pulling out of Iraq and, you know, trying to meet this deadline to prevent a cutting off of funding, which would be interpreted and spun as an abandonment of the troops who are out of country fighting a war, I think there's a lot of, especially Republicans, and a lot of Democrats, especially Southern Democrats, who will not fare well in the next election cycle if that goes through. So politically, I don't see how Feingold's resolution is viable. And I think he knows that. I think he's doing it more for the purpose of rising his national stature than anything else.
All right. And as a kind of a side note, I had a guest on earlier this week who was talking about the senator's resolution. And I asked him, you know, what are the chances? And he basically said, none. There are no chances that this will actually go anywhere. So we'll see how that actually plays out. It's 21 minutes past 8 o'clock now. We're doing the Week in Review here on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. Owen Robinson is one of our guests, conservative blogger with bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Ben Mansky also joins us, a fellow for the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution and former chair of the U.S. Green Party. I'm Gene Purcell, and for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 22 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and for Joy Cardine, it's the Week in Review. We do it every Friday morning during the 8 o'clock hour here on the Ideas Network. Take a look at all the topics of the week and comment on them from a variety of perspectives, including yours. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can call us from Madison. The local number is 263-1890. Our guests this week include Ben Mansky, a fellow for the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution and former chair of the U.S. Green Party. Owen Robinson is also with us, a conservative blogger with bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Let's go to the phones right now, and Dave joins us. He is in Wanakee. Good morning,
yes,
Dave.
Hello. I wanted to switch the topic to global warming, if I could. And there's a new report out by a collection of scientists, once again, a very well-known body of science, has stated unequivocally that global warming is occurring, and it's the result of man-made behavior. And I see us as being like frogs in this pan of water that's slowly heating up. And I'm wondering, are we going to jump out of the pan, or are we going to become frogs too?
All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. And we'll start with Owen Robinson on this. And I heard an update on that story just this morning, I think, on one of the newscasts I was listening to. The global warming is back and apparently with us to stay.
Well, you know, I'm always kind of struck a little askew by this debate, because it strikes me as interesting how much utter faith that people are demanding that we put in these kinds of reports. Now, I'm not saying that global warming isn't occurring, or even that it's not being caused by man. I have my doubts, but my problem with it is that when you have you know, people demanding that you agree with this, and you look back in our history, many of these scientists were saying in the 70s we were heading to the next ice age, and if you disagreed with them, then you were just completely wrong. There was a time when there was a unanimity of opinion that the Earth was flat and that the sun revolved around it. So to put this sort of technocratic faith in the scientific community is not always the best way to go. But my real problem is not whether it's occurring or whether it's man that's causing it. My real problem is the quote-unquote solutions that they're demanding that we enact. Some of their solutions, quote-unquote solutions, involved with cutting back our energy consumption, with restricting things, can absolutely devastate economies. And the cost of that, when we have millions of people whose quality of life declines, people starving, whatever it may be, because the consequences could be dire, and we frankly don't know what many of the consequences can be. We see, for instance, in Europe, they already can't meet the Kyoto Protocol targets that they signed up for because of the crippling effect it would have on their economy. So I guess for me, it's a question of whether is perhaps the cure that they're suggesting worse than the disease.
Ben Mansky.
Well, speaking of Europe, we've already seen the consequences with just incredible flooding year after year in different parts of Europe, with heat waves that have killed hundreds, actually over the years, thousands of people. And here in the United States, it's kind of stunning to me that after the experience of Katrina, which certainly is part of the pattern of increased volatility in terms of storms in this hemisphere, that we could talk about sort of the potential for economic harm when we're having real economic and real social harm that's occurring due to global warming already. I think the other question here too is sort of the ostrich effect. At what point does the ostrich pull its head out of the sand and look around and recognize that there's a problem? And even the president now has finally acknowledged, this oil man has acknowledged that this is a problem. But I think it's reasonable to raise it to the level of a crisis. And I think that the caller is right to raise this. And really, this is an issue that governments should rise and fall on. And in other countries, that's already happening. Here in the United States, I think increasingly, finally, decades after sort of first being introduced to the discourse in the 1970s, it's become an issue that all the presidential candidates are going to have to address. And I think it's something that we really have to push. I would just want to raise this sort of gets back to the issue of the viability of Feingold's Iraq Redeployment Act, and I think it applies certainly to finding real solutions to global warming, and that is the question of what the listeners are going to do, whether they're going to raise the heat. And I'm reminded of sort of that old Texas political expression, when I feel the heat, I always see the light. And I really, I realize that right now we don't have people in Congress who are listening to the American people on either of these issues. But I think it's incumbent upon us to make them listen, to see the light.
I would just like to underline part of the line of argument that that Ben made there, which I think really illustrates part of the farce that's going on with the global warming debate. He brought up Katrina as an example of global warming. Well, Katrina was a Category 3 hurricane, which we've seen quite a few of, that made landfall in a year that it was really where it hit more than anything particular about that hurricane. And furthermore, we talk about the increased hurricanes. This last hurricane season, which was predicted to be a very, very heavy, very deadly hurricane season, was virtually non-existent. I think that really underlines some of the problems that some of these computer models and all that they're basing these projections on, based on unreliable temperature measurements from 80 years ago, it's not a pure science. And there's so much opinion and so much politics injected into this debate right now that I think a lot of rational people are stepping back saying, wait a minute, what's going on? This isn't this isn't right.
Well, let's dig deeper into that. I think a lot of rational people are actually stepping up and saying this isn't right, and we've got to finally take some precautionary steps here. In terms of Katrina, I think it actually is a very good illustration, because what the modeling has been showing, and even after this year, scientists, the climatologists more and more agree on this, that we're seeing an increase in the frequency of these types of storms. And so as you increase the frequency, you have a higher possibility and likelihood that population centers will be hit over and over again, and that has been the experience. I mean, Katrina was the experience in the United States, but we saw the first hurricane in the southern hemisphere in South America. We saw just incredible storm damage in Mexico and Cuba and other parts of the Caribbean. I think that you're really just trying to obscure something and take a step back from something which is a growing scientific consensus here. And I think it's very interesting that you talked about the consensus around flat Earth and the world and the universe revolves around around planet Earth as opposed to the sun. I mean, I think we have to recognize that modern science emerged really as a reaction to the kind of orthodoxy that you're talking about. And today we have the Bush administration increasingly stepping in and telling climatologists what they can and cannot talk about. I mean, one of the other stories that came up recently this week was the survey of 279 climatologists conducted by the Union of Concerned Scientists, who said that they've been told to remove the phrases, over 50% of them have been told to remove the phrases global warming or climate change from the reports. And so if you want to talk about orthodoxy, I think we have an oil orthodoxy, and these disinterested scientists are really have a lot more credibility, I think, with most of us.
And I hate to end this conversation right here, but we've got a lot of ground to cover. So I'm going to bring up kind of a related topic, and then we're going to move on to national news. On a related topic, and I'll let Owen start on this, Al Gore was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. What do you think about that?
I think that at the point where the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to a terrorist, Yasser Arafat, it became a meaningless prize. And now that a person's being nominated who has done, you know, we can argue about whether his efforts have been for good or ill, but the fact that it has nothing whatsoever to do with war or peace tells me that it's become no longer anything about true peace prize. On the other side of that, I'll also underline that Rush Limbaugh was also nominated for it, and I pose that for the same reason, the reason why a radio talk show host who's done nothing regarding war or peace should be nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize just seems to me to underline how absurd that prize has become.
Well, we'll see who's awarded the prize, and that's all I'll leave it on because I can't disagree with you about the rest of it.
Okay, let's move on and find out what listeners have to say. Bob joins us, and he is in Fond du Lac. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, good morning. I think that it's interesting that the Scooter Libby trial has pulled the curtain back, you know, like at the Wizard of Oz. And what we're finding is that the Bush administration has in the past and continues today to lie as the standard operating procedure of their day-to-day activity more than any other administration in history. We know that in October, before the State of the Union speech, the CIA told Bush, take that uranium out of your speech because it's not true. It went into the speech. They told Scott McClellan to lie to the press about the involvement of Karl Rove and Scooter Libby. They told him to go out and lie. The president said, if anyone in my administration is involved, we're going to get rid of him. At the time he said that, he knew that Libby and Rove were behind it. Vice President Cheney, we now have handwritten notes that have been introduced as evidence telling Libby to out Valerie Plame as a CIA officer. And the reason they did this...
Okay, I think we got the idea here, Bob. The Scooter Libby trial underway in Washington, and I think in a relatively slow news week, might have had a higher profile, but I had to say I'd forgotten all about it till I saw the copy this morning. Ben Mansky, any revelations coming out of that that are news to you?
Well, I think we just heard some of them. I honestly was with you. I had forgotten about this story, and it shows how much it had sort of disappeared from the limelight over the last year or two. There's so many reasons for Congress to take affirmative steps to go after this administration, and I think certainly the sort of the Libby trial, the outing of Valerie Plame, is sort of one. It's something that's getting dug into now that is going to provide, I think, more ammunition for those who really say, no, it's time to put impeachment back on the table and to put pressure on members of Congress to do that. But I think there's a lot of other issues here, too, which frankly concern me. just as much, if not more, and it has overall to do with the enlargement of the powers of the executive branch at the expense of the legislative branch, and frankly, at the expense of the republic that this nation is, purports to be. We see that in presidential signing statements most recently now with sort of the Bush administration creating a new doctrine around sort of the grail of the market. Requiring that, that regulations that are promulgated by our federal regulatory agencies provide a justification as to how the market has failed in this particular instance if they are going to move to regulate. In other words, that becomes the standard by which you know, public health and safety is judged. You know, they're basically changing. They're taking on powers which the Constitution very clearly does not provide the executive branch, and we see it in so many areas, in the question of war-making power, and the question of spying on the American people, and in terms of protecting our health and the public interest in the regulatory sphere, and it really is time for Congress to step up.
Owen Robinson, a couple of points there. First, your reaction to Scooter Libby's trial. Is it flying under the radar for you as it has been for other people? Any revelations from that that you'd like to comment on? And then finally, if you could pick up on Ben's point, he sees that as sort of a larger symbolism of some of what he sees as an enlargement of presidential powers. Do you see anything similar?
Well, boy, after Ben went through all that, I'd forgotten what the original question was.
Well, see, I take notes because I forget, too. I can't keep track of all this stuff without writing it down.
First, let us work with an established set of facts, and that's that Fitzgerald already determined that Valerie Plame was not protected or was not classified as a covert agent, and so therefore the outing or the underlying supposed crime never existed. What Scooter Libby is being prosecuted for is perjury, because he says that he learned of Valerie Plame from one person when it turns out he learned it from another person. And the fact, and he claims he didn't remember it correctly. Fitzgerald is alleging that he lied. But when you dig into this sort of minutia from years ago, this is what happens. You get conflicting stories. You get different things going on. And I think the aggressive prosecution of Scooter Libby by Fitzgerald is more it shows what happens when special prosecutors get into Washington and get out of control. I do think that it's interesting to compare this case with a parallel case, and that's Sandy Berger, the former Clinton National Security Advisor, who was caught red-handed stealing security documents out of the archives by stuffing them in his socks. Now, he got a slap on the wrist, and it's turning out now that there was no inventory of the documents that he was stealing. So we don't know what Mr. Berger stole or what he gave back. He says he gave everything back, but all we have is his word on that. So here we have a high-ranking official who stole documents clearly with the intent to conceal their existence from the 9/11 commission. He gets a slap on the wrist. Scooter Libby doesn't remember who told him about Valerie Plame, and he's getting run through the ringer. So I think it's a much greater illustration of what really piques people's interest and what doesn't in our current political climate. As for expanding powers of the executive, that's been happening for a long, long time, and frankly, I think the largest surge to the executive happened under Lincoln and then under FDR. Whether Bush is doing it more so, I don't know. He seems to be working within the rules established before. I think more what Ben is complaining about is that up until the last couple years, probably the last 3 years, when President Bush had overwhelming public support for his actions, Congress was mute to debate him because of fear of political reprisals. And that's more a statement of politics than actual power. Congress hasn't ceded any of its power. It's a matter of whether they choose to exercise it.
You're listening to The Week in Review here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine. We're going to continue our discussion. We'll be turning to state news from here in Wisconsin after this break here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn is in with her guest John Nichols, and this morning they'll be paying tribute to Molly Ivins, who died Wednesday in Texas. They'll be discussing what they call the best in journalism today. That's up next hour after 9 here on the Ideas Network. For the next few minutes, though, we will continue our week in review. Owen Robinson is with us, a conservative blogger with bootsandsaddles.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Also joining us, Ben Mansky, a fellow for the Liberty Tree Foundation and former chair of the U.S. Green Party. Returning to Wisconsin news right now, and I'd like to play a clip from Governor Doyle's State of the State address that we heard earlier this week.
Too many of our kids are still lighting up. Too many lives are being cut short, and the cost has swelled into the billions. In fact, Wisconsin taxpayers are forced to pay about $500 million every year in Medicaid costs directly related to smoking. And so, after consulting with public health leaders from around the state, I am proposing to raise Wisconsin's tobacco tax by $1.25 a pack.
Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle from earlier this week in his State of the State address, and as always, State of the State addresses contain a lot of stuff. His State of the State included a lot of talk about smoking, about health care. In addition to the raise in cigarette taxes, he's also proposing a statewide smoking ban in work buildings and public places. Let's start with Ben Mansky on this. So what did you think of the governor's State of the State overall, and any comments that you would have on the specifics of it?
Well, I think some of the Democratic listeners who are more fans of the governor will be surprised to hear me say this, but it was an improvement over past State of the States, and certainly a little more optimistic about what we can expect from this Doyle administration than from previous. But at the same time, you have to look at this last election and sort of the overwhelming mandate, pretty much against Mark Green, I'd say more than anything else. And ask whether Doyle is really using all the capital that's available to him to take the kinds of steps. I mean, he's got a limited time in office, and you look at some of these initiatives, for example, in healthcare. Okay, great. So we're going to expand Badger Care. That's good. That's a good step. But still, they're proposing to cover 71,000 out of the 276,000 uninsured in the state. And there's something that the governor could do instead, which would go much further, but which does have support in the legislature, and that is get behind the Wisconsin Health Security Act. And I'll refer listeners to the Coalition for Wisconsin Health, which is one of the main advocacy groups that's been pushing this for years. I mean, all the polling for years has shown that most respondents are in favor of a form of single-payer universal health care. This act would create a health trust fund at the state level to provide for all of us. And here he is proposing something that would only deal with roughly, maybe a quarter of the uninsured in the state of Wisconsin. I think he should go further and be more courageous here. In terms of the smoking ban, I do see this as a personal liberty issue. And by that, I mean it's an issue of personal liberty not to get poisoned in public or on the job. And it's incredible to me that we're living in a day and age where, despite sort of the consensus, again, that the tobacco industry has basically been engaging in legally approved murder for generations now, that they're still pulling in record profits. So I do think it's a step forward, so long as the state legislation that the governor is proposing doesn't result in preemption of local laws. We do need a measure of local control for municipalities to take a step forward. So this should be a floor and not a ceiling.
Owen Robinson, your reaction to the governor's State of the State, any highlights, any reactions?
Overall, I agree with Ben that what we saw was a governor who was emboldened by the election, by the fact that his party took over the state Senate and made serious gains in the assembly. He's only a 3-vote margin away from basically any agenda item he wants. He's cast aside his fiscal discipline rhetoric of the previous term. If you remember back, for instance, his 2003 State of the State, where he stated unequivocally that he would not raise taxes. Now, of course, he did, but it's clear that he's abandoned that rhetoric in favor of a more liberal agenda, a more socialist agenda, and that certainly is his right. I don't think he's reading the politics on it quite right. I don't think that what we saw in Wisconsin was a sweep against Mark Green, for instance. What we saw was a nationwide sweep against a variety of things, against the Republican Party. And so whether that translates into a mandate for many of these specific policy initiatives, I'm not so sure, but I think time will tell. Certainly Doyle is in a much better position to advance this kind of agenda than he was last year, the year before, the last budget cycle. So it'll be interesting to see how he gets it through. On these specific policy initiatives, what I see is a whole lot of spending and no way to pay for it and still saying he's not going to raise taxes generally. And I don't see how you accomplish that without either massive debt or some other gimmick. And keeping in mind that we still have anywhere from a $1.6 to a $2.5 billion structural deficit that he didn't even say how he was going to address that. He has a tax increase with the cigarette tax increase, which does fall on the lower echelons on society much more heavily. It is a very, very, very regressive tax, which is why I'm always a bit surprised when folks like Ben support things like that.
Talk about cigarette tax.
Oh, well. as for the specific things, you know, really, we could talk about any of these for a complete show. As far as highlights, I do think that obviously the cigarette tax and smoking ban are obviously very important to Governor Doyle. It's likely he's going to get some version of those passed. Whether it's to the extent he wants, I don't know. I think they are both bad ideas for reasons too extensive to go into at the moment. For his health care, I thought another thing that was interesting with his health care, how he talks about covering, for instance, children and stuff, and for his education policy of paying for people's college education if they maintain a B with the Wisconsin Covenant, regardless of income. And this is kind of a new thing that Doyle has stretched in here, where no longer is the rhetoric or the policy centered around the poor or the disadvantaged. It's centered around everyone. It is a true socialist program where, regardless of income, the government will take care of that for you, or rather will tax you for it and then tell you what to do. And I don't know that if the average middle-class Wisconsin taxpayer is going to be real keen on paying for health care or a college education for the kids of the Cole family or the wealthy of the state.
Yeah, I don't know if they go to the UW, but
yeah, but I don't know that I don't know if that gets through the more liberal parts of the legislature, particularly the state senate, which has taken serious bent to the left. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I think more interesting will be to see his budget address, which I believe is on the 13th,
February,
and see how he plans to actually pay for all of this.
Yep, and it will be. That is coming up on February 13th. You're right about that. So the state of the state, usually a chance for a governor to talk about all the good things that they want to do. Some other news for the Doyle administration this week. This is out of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel from February 1st. Did Doyle appointee Stahl report, and the lead is two of Governor Jim Doyle's appointees told a Department of Transportation attorney to delay the release of a politically damaging 2004 report in apparent violation of the state open records law. The attorney testified on Thursday. It's sort of a convoluted tale as you read into it, but certainly can't be good news for the Doyle administration. We'll start with Owen Robinson and his reaction to this.
I think that this is a... It illustrates exactly how Doyle has been working for years, but we've already seen instances of this. We saw one person convicted of felonies for something very similar, where it looked like Doyle appointees meddled with state policy in order to benefit donors or to support his political agenda. We saw it with him allegedly, and this is still under investigation, but manipulating the Public Service Commission regarding plant sales and such. This case is actually very interesting because it's so clear, where you have a person who wanted to, in the Department of Transportation, who wanted to release a report. A Doyle appointee came to him, all of this, of course, is allegedly, but this is in sworn testimony, came to him and told him to delay the report until the Department of Administration could actually write a rebuttal to it, essentially, and release them at the same time. because the report from the DOT didn't jive with what Doyle was telling the public in his rhetoric. And then when that DOT official was later uncooperative, he was sacked. He was moved out of that position, and somebody who worked on Doyle's campaign, a former district attorney, was put back in that position. In other words, he was moved out of the way, and a much more reliable Doyle advocate was put in his place. And I think that Doyle's melding of politics and policy have been very clear, and they've been clear for quite some time, but it's also very clear that too many people in Wisconsin don't really care because we reelected them, and frankly, we get the government we vote for.
Ben Mensky.
Well, I think I fundamentally agree with the critique of the Doyle-Thompson administration. I mean, this has been a longstanding problem in Wisconsin politics, and it's one of the reasons why in my private capacity I served as treasurer for Nelson Eisman's campaign, who made clean government one of his key issues. And I do think it's going to be important for people to join the fight for public financing of elections to get money out of politics. What we've seen, I think, is the corporatization of government in Wisconsin, and we've seen it in every aspect of our state in terms of university, in terms of elections, in terms of lobbying. And I think this particular instance is just one more example. I think it's interesting here that, you know, we have conservatives who are raising a cry about this scandal over outsourcing. And the basic issue here is that state workers get the job done better than these corporate firms. And so I think that it is, it's indicative of why we really need to sort of stop accepting the choices that are handed to us, but create alternatives and independent sort of bases of power for real political reform. So I'm excited to see what happens with public financing this year, because I know that that's on the agenda for most of the good government groups here in Wisconsin. And I also think, frankly, there's a lot of benefits to get back to this other sort of topic we were talking about earlier with the state of the state and the upcoming budget proposal. All these questions are related, obviously. And if you want to really get to the bottom of the question of, you know, why do we have regressive taxation in the state of Wisconsin? Why are we raising the cigarette tax rather than bringing back progressive income tax that we used to have back in the golden days of the 1950s? Why aren't the corporations paying their fair share? Why are we passing the buck to the poorest in the state? Why has tuition increased at 2 to 3 times the cost of living over the last generation? Well, I think it's pretty clear. Money calls a shot, money talks, and it's up to us to take money out of politics.
On kind of a related note, and I'm going to ask you both to be relatively short on this because we're running short of time. Two things have happened in state government. The ethics reform bill, that should be signed today, I think. And then the governor also then called for campaign finance reform, even though I think there was a report here. Yeah, there was a news on the AP that this was the most expensive gubernatorial race in state history. So a couple of items there that are sort of related to what we were just speaking of. And let's start with Ben Mansky on this. The ethics reform bill, does that help out anything in your estimation? And this idea of campaign finance reform, we've heard a lot of talk about it. Is anything going to happen on this?
Again, affirmative steps, at least in terms of the ethics legislation, still some problems with it. It is fundamentally still a bipartisan commission, even though they've supposedly taken the partisanship out. It's still pretty much controlled by the two parties that run the system, and that's not, I think, in the interest of the voters. And I think there are some criticisms that have been raised by the League of Women Voters and others about some of the elements that were put into this legislation. Without getting into that because we're short on time, I'll just say, look, I mean, I use the word crisis a lot, and I really do feel like we have a whole series of crises we're dealing with, and one of those, again, is this question of corporate capture of our government. I'd like to see the governor get behind public financing, and short of him doing that, I think it's going to take a kind of uprising all over the state with people going after their state legislators and bird-dogging them and hassling them and, you know, asking them when they're going to get on board with public financing of elections and getting the corporate money out. That's what it's going to take to clean up government in Wisconsin.
Owen Robinson.
Well, actually, I think this is a very good ethics reform bill. There are a couple problems with it. But overall, I think we've seen that the current system of the State Elections Board and the Ethics Board are absolutely defunct. And I think this goes as far as as reasonably possible within a political system. You have an entity that's created by a political system. Finding people to sit on an accountability board who have never been involved in politics is going to be almost impossible. So within the confines of human nature, I think it does the best job of removing the influence that politics can have on an accountability board like that. That being said, until we fundamentally ethics is a personal thing, and until legislators and people in elected office personally decide to act ethically and morally, they will find a way to be unethical. So fundamentally, we need to elect ethical people. That's the best way to ethics reform. As far as the money in politics issue and campaign finance reform, I'm actually finding the whole campaign finance reform progress to be coming almost comical, and that we keep coming up with these bills and laws to, quote-unquote, get the money out of politics, and we squeeze the balloon and it pops up somewhere else. The problem with money in politics is not has to do with the power of government. The more power the government has in our everyday lives, the more interest people have in influencing that government, and the more money they are willing to spend to influence that government. If we would scale back our government to a much more limited, constitutionally sound role, then I think you'd see a lot of money drop out of politics, because who cares what the government's doing when it's not interfering in our life at every single step, from how many gallons we use to flush our toilet to what kind of gas we put in our cars.
Okay, we've only got a minute left, and one final story here. This just passed over the AP wire. And I'll just ask for short comments from each of you. We have some conflicting predictions from the furry forecasters today. Doesn't everybody love fun stories to end things with? In Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, Jimmy the Groundhog saw his shadow, predicting 6 more weeks of winter. The more famous Pennsylvania groundhog, Punxsutawney Phil, did not see his shadow, predicting an early spring. So the question, Ben Mansky, is who do you believe, Jimmy or Phil?
You're asking that as a question.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, gosh, I mean, I don't know the Badgers haven't played the Nittany Lions yet, but I figure they'll win that game, and I'm siding with Jimmy on this thing.
All right, Owen Robinson.
I think what we see is both of these, the global warming debate playing out with groundhogs.
All right, fair enough. Owen Robinson, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Owen Robinson, a conservative blogger with bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Ben Mansky, thanks for joining us this morning as well.
You bet.
Ben Mansky, former chair of the U.S. Green Party and fellow for the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution. And we've been talking about the week in review during this 8 o'clock hour. Karen Prager produced the program and also provided us with on-air production this morning. And thanks to all of you for joining us and phoning in with your comments. I'm Gene Purcell, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.